They can send non-perishable food. They can send hats and gloves, maybe warm clothing. Prayer, a lot of prayer works too.
Savoonga residents struggle with low supplies and no power. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 30th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, proponents of Alaska Native corporations are dismayed at attacks on 8A contracting.
They've glommed on to one situation and are trying to make that representative of the broader Alaska Native corporation community. And frankly, I don't think that that's accurate.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
On St. Lawrence Island, power outages in Savoonga are being blamed on high winds and severe weather. The power went down 4 days ago, and as of today, an estimated 80 homes are still without electricity, some frozen solid, according to reports. Biting cold has forced more than 100 people to take shelter in the local school, where supplies of food and essential items are running thin. Savoonga's mayor has asked the American Red Cross for assistance. And today, an air shipment of emergency supplies left Anchorage for the St. Lawrence Island community by way of Nome, according to the Red Cross's Katie Bender. Meanwhile, in Anchorage, Yari Kin-Iguk is concerned about her relatives and friends in her hometown.
And a lot of people are staying at the school to stay warm, more than 150 people, and some people staying at the city hall and people staying at the fire department. And I just learned a little bit earlier that people are starting to lack food because of the food damage because of no electricity.
Kinney Cook is in touch with a niece in Savoonga through the social networking site Facebook. She says lack of power is only escalating the damage.
Yeah, and a lot of the houses, the pipes are bursting because their pipes are now frozen.
Alaska Village Electric Cooperative supplies power to Savoonga residents. Company officials say severe weather and below zero temperatures caused some power lines to freeze and slap against each other, which caused the initial outage. Crews are working to restore power. Kinney Cook says she's trying to organize people to help Savoonga residents.
They can send non-perishable food. They can send hats and gloves, maybe warm clothing. Prayer, a lot of prayer works too.
Katie Bender with the Red Cross says financial donations can be made through the Red Cross website. Search and rescue crews from Nome and Teller are continuing the search for John Kazuna 10 days after he began walking to Nome. From KNOM, Ben Matheson reports.
State troopers said that rescue crews did not send out ground searchers today due to difficult weather conditions. Nome Post Sergeant Andrew Merrill says this weekend, ground search efforts will be launched from the Woolly Lagoon area.
Plans are, depending on the weather this weekend, Nome Search and Rescue Group is going to try and do a ground search starting from the cabin outward from there.
Aerial search efforts have included aircraft from the state troopers, Fish and Game, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Air Force sent a C-130 from Anchorage yesterday with technology to remotely detect heat, but the search turned up no clues.
The issue is just with the weather conditions and the temperatures, it's not the most effective means of locating someone. If they're buried under the snow or up underneath something, that technology is not going to pinpoint them as if, you know, they were walking around. So, I mean, we employed it yesterday with little success. The Air Force was actually able to do a really good search pattern. They were comfortable with the pattern they did in eliminating the possibility that he was there.
Sergeant Merrill says that troopers have put together a weather overview for the time that Kazuna is said to have left his cabin. Winds were blowing around 25 miles per hour, which could limit the distance that Kazuna traveled. Sergeant Merrill says that the search area remains large and crews are covering all possibilities.
Yesterday, search and rescue from Teller actually rode the coast down from Teller to check to see if maybe he got turned around and headed that direction instead. They did not see any signs or locate him. So we've basically taken the search area from, Nome to Teller along the coast.
As muskox season opens in the new year, Sergeant Merrill is requesting that hunters keep an eye out and report anything suspicious to the troopers. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
A Native 8A Advocacy Association has denounced what it calls a one-sided story about Alaska Native corporations and the Small Business Administration's 8A program, which provides the corporations with special advantages in competing for federal contracts. The story, by a reporter with the online public interest news site ProPublica, ran in USA Today earlier this month. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
As an example of what he calls SBA 8A program abuses, author Michael Grable says lawsuits, investigations, and audits of the affairs of the Cape Fox Village Corporation show that from 2003 to 2008, annual revenues jumped from $8 million to more than $200 million. Consultants and subsidiary managers made millions in salaries, bonuses, and consulting fees. But Cape Fox profits dropped by $1.2 million, and shareholders saw no increase in their dividends. Grable says this points to a pattern in which non-natives from the Washington, D.C. area and elsewhere gain control of Native corporate subsidiaries to get sole-source contracts of unlimited size. Not so, says Sarah Lukin, director of the Native American Contractors Association.
If I look at the ProPublica piece, it appears to me that they've glommed onto one situation and are trying to make that representative of the broader Alaska Native Corporation community. And frankly, I don't think that that's accurate.
Lukin says not only is the Cape Fox situation a rare, isolated event, but it was the subject of an inspector general's investigation years ago.
When I read the article put together by ProPublica, it sounded like this was like a brand new issue that they were unveiling, like something, you know, new and but that's really not the case.
Grable and others have also criticized the program, saying increased revenues are not benefiting corporate shareholders. Lukin says that as Grable was researching his article, she sent him information showing that 8A profits have allowed corporations to provide substantial economic benefits, including $181 million in dividends, scholarships, and endowments in 2008 alone from 12 regional corporations. But she says that information was not reflected in Grable's story. The Small Business Administration is working on changes to set contract dollar limits and increase oversight. Meanwhile, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Contract Oversight, and Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson have introduced legislation that would remove from the SBA 8A program preferences and special rules for Alaska Native corporations and villages. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Governor Sean Parnell and Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell today signed the final certification documents declaring Senator Lisa Murkowski the winner of the 2010 U.S. Senate race. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai will hand-carry the documents to Washington, D.C. to be filed with the U.S. Senate Secretary's office. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, high hopes for power generation from Alaska rivers.
We want to first prove out the prototype, of course, and then see, well, do we want to continue with the business plan and go ahead and offer it to the state and even beyond there, the nation?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
For those resolving to fix their financial and debt problems in 2011, the Better Business Bureau has some warnings to heed and some resources to use. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Debt problems can strike any time of the year, but Tara Sims, public relations manager for the Alaska Office of the Better Business Bureau, says recent holiday spending plus winter costs can foster an out-of-control spin for personal finances.
maybe consumers' bills just added up a little bit more during the holiday times than they thought. Maybe the heating bills are more expensive than they estimated, or perhaps the family just is under hard times right now. And when those January bills come around, they might be thinking about trying to find some help and resources to avoid going further into debt.
Because of the seasonal financial pressure, the Bureau has issued a guide to debt resolution and money management. The guide, along with other tips, is available by going to the website of the Better Business Bureau of Alaska. The Bureau's advice is timely. Companies claiming they can rescue the debt-laden are already increasing their television ads now that the holidays are nearly over and January bills will soon be in the mail. While debts can cause stress and a desire for an immediate solution, Sims advises caution.
The debt negotiation, also sometimes called debt settlement, it's just really important for consumers to do their research. There's some great companies out there that can be a help to consumers, and there's also sometimes some offers that sometimes consumers can go in a different route would be better. So it's just really important to check out the business, get a BV reliability report, make sure and find out if the offer is going to affect your credit negatively or not. Make sure it's something that you can't do on your own.
By on your own, Sims means personally contacting the creditors and trying to work out a payment plan with them. And then, she stressed, keep in touch with them and know exactly the month-to-month status of your debt. Factual monthly reports are also a good idea, even if you're working through a debt management company. And if you choose to work through a company, research it thoroughly first. One way is by, once again, going to the Better Business Bureau of Alaska website. And watch for some red flags, such as the term debt elimination.
Debt doesn't go away overnight. It takes some time to fix problems and find ways to pay back debts.
Sims says some debt assistance firms will lure clients into a false sense of security over debt disappearance with a pseudo-certificate.
We've seen cases where people get a certificate from a business and they've paid for this certificate that basically says that their debts are no longer due, that it's all covered and paid for. However, there's no legal authority with this paperwork. It's just they've paid for a piece of paper. It doesn't have any legal standing.
Another tip? Sims says it's also imperative to verify the legitimacy of any unexpected debt collection calls.
If somebody is calling you and claiming that you owe a debt, ask for them to send the information in writing. That way you can substantiate the debt. Do not provide bank account, credit card information, or other personal information over the phone without confirming the legitimacy of the call.
Nor is it sufficient for a debt collector to write simply that his firm has obtained or purchased the debt from another company. By federal law, collectors must be able to track the debt back to its origin and supply that information to the person it says owes the money. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska's four presiding Superior Court judges will retain their positions for 2011. Supreme Court Chief Justice Walter L. Carpanetti announced today that Judge Patricia Collins will preside over the 1st Judicial District, which covers southeast Alaska. Judge Ben Esch will oversee the 2nd Judicial District, which covers Alaska's most northern areas and includes Superior Courts in Barrow, Nome, and Kotzebue. Judge Sharon Gleason will remain presiding judge for the 3rd Judicial District, covering Anchorage and South Central Alaska, and Judge Douglas Blankenship of Fairbanks will preside over the 4th Judicial District, which covers the interior and parts of Southwest. Chief Justice Carpanetti also today reappointed Judge Robert G. Coates as Chief Justice of the Alaska Court of Appeals. Coates has served on the Appeals Court since it was created in 1980. Before his appointment, he was an assistant attorney general and an assistant public defender in Fairbanks and Kenai. Coates is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He's lived in Alaska for more than four decades. The three-judge court hears appeals from judgments in criminal cases. The court also hears cases of juvenile delinquency, prisoners challenging the legality of their confinement, and probation and parole decisions. The city of Barrow is being awarded nearly $5 million in federal grants to pay for a new boat launch and a complete renovation of the city's recreation center. The funds are part of an impact mitigation program, which gives a percentage of National Petroleum Reserve Alaska lease sales to impacted communities. In Barrow, KBRW's Jake Neer has the story.
City of Barrow officials are receiving two NPRA impact mitigation grants to pay for a pair of major upcoming city projects. The first is a $600,000 grant request to build a boat launch on North Salt Lagoon to allow safe access to the Arctic Ocean during boating season. City officials raised about $1.5 million for the project and originally intended to complete the launch without any federal help. However, when the project went to bid, they were still more than $500,000 short of the lowest reliable offer. With the grant, the city has roughly $2.5 million for the project. City of Barrow Mayor Bob Harcharek says the boat launch is essential for safe subsistence practices.
The people that go subsistence hunting and fishing or camping need a safe access to get out into the ocean. Being in the lagoon, there'll be some dredging. There'll be a boat dock with two ramps into the water. There'll be tie-up space for boats out there, so it will be safe and it'll be accessible for the entire boating season.
Mayor Harcharek says he expects to have the boat launch completed by summer 2012 if all goes according to plan. The other grant is a $4.3 million complete renovation of Barrow's Piragvik Recreation Facility. Mayor Harcharek says the city's population has about doubled since Piragvik was built, and so in turn have demands on the facility.
The current recreation facility is probably 20-some years old and is suffering from lack of preventive maintenance plus use. It was built when the town population was about 2,200, and now the population of Barrow is around 4,500 people.
City officials are also applying for an additional $15 million legislative grant for an addition to the facility. Harcharek says he's dubbing the renovation and addition Phase 1 and 2, respectively, of a single project to get Piragvik back up to snuff. With the grant for Phase 1 already awarded, he says the renovation of the current facility should be started and completed this summer. The mayor says he'll be pleasantly shocked if the legislature approves all $15 million for the Phase 2 addition to the facility, but he says he'll take anything he can get. He says he hopes voters will petition for and approve a measure in 2011 to allow the city to own and operate a controlled access liquor store in town. City officials expect such a move would bring in about $4 million in additional net revenue to the city every year. Mayor Harcharek says he'd use that money to pay for the rest of the Piragvik expansion project. City officials are currently waiting for final notification from the state to be able to use the NPRA funds to put the boat launch and Piragvik renovation projects up for bid. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Two communities in the interior may soon harness an abundant form of green energy to generate electricity, the power of a rushing river. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Nenana and Big Delta may soon become the latest Alaskan communities to generate electricity with a type of small-scale hydroelectric system called an in-river turbine. It's part of an effort to develop the so-called hydrokinetic technology to generate electricity for small communities without having to burn expensive, dirty fossil fuels like diesel or coal. An Anchorage-based company reportedly has applied for a federal permit to allow the company, ORPC Alaska, to install a turbine in the Tanana River in Nenana. If all goes according to plan, ORPC hopes to be generating up to 300 kilowatts from the river turbine in 2012, according to a Monday story on the Fairbanks Daily News Miner's website. Nenana would be the second such turbine proposed for the Tanana. Backers of another effort underway in Big Delta hope to put a prototype system in the Tanana next year. Steve Salvaggio, a principal with Whitestone Power and Communications, says his company received a $180,000 federal grant earlier this month to develop a prototype 100-kilowatt river turbine that his company hopes to test next year in a spot in the Tanana just downstream from the confluence of the Delta and Tanana rivers. Salvaggio hopes to get a bigger state grant next year from the Alaska Energy Authority, or AEA, as a sort of seed money to help the company continue development of the system.
And so the next thing we're going to be looking at is the Emerging Technologies Fund with AEA, as soon as the governor or the legislature signs off on it. AEA is going to, you know, get something together, present it to the legislature, and I think there's going to be a funding purse of around $5 million. That's not very much when you think about it. These projects are very, very expensive to get off the ground.
Salvaggio says the Whitestone utility hopes to develop a system that the company could market to remote locales in need of cheaper power, such as villages in Alaska and eventually elsewhere.
What we want to do is we want to first prove out the prototype, of course, and then see, well, do we want to continue with the business plan and go ahead and offer it to the state and even beyond there, the nation?
Salvaggio says he's meeting with state officials this week to get authorization for a power line right-of-way to connect the river turbine to the grid. He hopes the turbine will be producing power for a community on the west side of the Tanana in 2012. Meanwhile, a Washington state-based utility is taking account of lessons learned over the past summer from its prototype river turbine it installed near Eagle. Ben Best, an engineer with Alaska Power and Telephone, said AP&T crews had to endure a trial by fire and ice and floods just to get its 25-kilowatt turbine placed in the Yukon River near Eagle.
We had lots of ups and downs this year.
AP&T's experimental project was funded by the Denali Commission and supported by the UAF's Alaska Center for Energy and Power. ACEP also is providing technical support for the turbine project near Nenana. Best said AP&T crews first had to work around wildfires that sprang up around Tok in May to get their equipment and crews up the Taylor Highway to Eagle. Then they had to wait until the warm weather melted chunks of ice, some as big as a house, that were dumped around Eagle by breakup on the Yukon upstream. AP&T workers finally got the turbine installed in the river in June and managed to keep it running for several weeks in between damage caused by logs and other debris carried along by the Yukon. The company had to pull the turbine from the river for a couple of weeks later in the summer when heavy rains caused the Yukon to flood, bringing waves of debris that battered the turbine. Then they had to deal with washouts on the Taylor Highway through late summer to bring crews and equipment in to repair and maintain the turbine. Best and others developing the in-river turbine systems all agree they have a lot to learn to make the technology work in order to provide relatively cheap electricity.
The lessons that we have learned in Eagle, you know, we aren't maybe directly transferable because technology is different in different locations. The Nana project is using a different type of hydrokinetic technology. They'll have different problems associated with it, but they can learn from our experiences.
But if the logistical hurdles can be overcome, the developers of the technology believe there's a big potential for this form of green energy here in Alaska.
We think the hydrokinetic has a lot of potential, but we have to overcome what really are economic issues. We can't deploy people up to Eagle every time the unit has trouble. We have to figure out a way to make the system such that the manpower that we have in Eagle can take care of it. After what we survived last year, our feeling is that if you can make it work on Yukon, you can make it work anywhere.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska coastal communities that are considering the ocean for power might want to keep an eye on Oregon, where marine energy developers are looking for ways to make electricity from the sea. The alternative energy sector has been slow to coalesce around one technology. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on the proliferation of creative electric engineering on the coast.
It's a mouth-watering display if you're an ocean energy developer. Huge waves crash against the jetties at the mouth of Tillamook Bay. Columns of spray shoot into the air. One company is thinking about redesigning these jetties with electricity generators built inside.
When the waves crash or hit against this device, water fills these chambers and runs into the back where the turbine is. And basically, it's very similar to a hydroelectric dam where water just flows through and drives the turbine.
Stephanie Thornton is the American Program Director for the aptly named Norwegian company Wave Energy. Thornton describes her industry as in its infancy. It's in a period of great experimentation, the panoply of creative technologies.
Once they figure out if it can work from a technical standpoint, then it's the business side of it. The economics may be the key issue.
For now, for every failed pioneer company, about two new startups show up on our coast. Kevin Bannister describes his company's plans for a floating wind farm offshore of Manzanita or Neatarts, Oregon.
The design came from the oil and gas industry, so semi-submersible platforms like this one are not terribly new. The integration with a wind turbine, however, is a new idea.
Yet another company diving in is a Salem-based startup. Its idea relies on wave pressure passing over air-filled pillows on the seafloor. The pulses compress air, which can then be used to spin an electric turbine. Tillamook PUD manager Pat Ashby has seen even more far-out ideas cross his desk.
So we've become kind of a bullseye for world developers.
First to connect to the grid will likely be a bobbing buoy generator next year off Reedsport. Ashby says the floating wind farm also seems plausible near term because wind power is well understood.
The others have got new technology that needs to be tested. It's not really existing anywhere in the world right now. And so the devices that produce the energy and their ability to withstand salt water, corrosive elements, need a lot of work yet.
Ashby says community acceptance also needs some work yet. At the port of Garibaldi, Oregon, Darren Mobley prepares his boat for winter crabbing. He's among the many fishermen and crabbers who remain skeptical of ocean energy.
Yeah, and they're talking about a big area around them that would be closed to fishing. And we can't afford to have any more fishing ground taken from us.
Electric generation attached to a jetty is the only idea that wins favor from this fisherman. I'm Tom Bonsi in Tillamook, Oregon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Nome, Jake Neer in Barrow, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Northwest News Network's Tom Bonsi in Tillamook, Oregon. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.